This is Angle of View. Today is July 15th, 2025. I'm Will Hatman. F1 is a gigantic, splashy merger between an aging movie star and a spectator sport of flagging viewership, whipped up in a frantic effort to revive interest in both. In a gesture of the kind of corporate nudity which once was only seen under court order, but which now simply indicates a world in which brands are no longer regarded with the faintest trace of suspicion, the movie is named not merely after the sport, but after its logo, which is what appears on screen after a Joseph Kosinski film. Let me say this again. The F1 logo is the title. It's like if a movie about a pro basketball player were named JerryWestOutline.jpg. The movie's entire appearance follows in this spirit of totalizing and unashamed advertisement. It is identical to one of those it-all-comes-down-to-this promo packages that the sports leagues air at playoff time, except 156 minutes long and containing absolutely none of the surprises that real sports footage supplies. It is possibly the slickest movie I have ever seen, as slick as the polished steel that takes up most of the screen most of the time. Every surface gleams impossibly. It's like it takes place in a world without fingerprints. The branding within the film is as insanely prodigious as the branding surrounding it, so thick in the visual field that it seems to be spreading as you watch, like kudzu. The top incentive of the film's seven producers must have been rooted in the knowledge that any film about Formula One racing would be required in the name of authenticity to reproduce the extreme density of advertising baked into the real sport, and that the more authentic the presentation and the longer the running time, the greater the portion of the budget that could be defrayed by product placement. Though incidentally, we'll never know by how much. The film's budget is, as is more and more often the case these days, a figure to be estimated rather than disclosed. But the humblest of the estimates recorded is $200 million. Our hero's team is a fictitious car maker, Apex GP, but their sponsor is the very real Expensify, a rent-seeking fintech app that helps business people file expense reports for reimbursement. This is the scrappy underdog that you will be asked to spend 2.5 hours rooting for. The basic outline of the story is this. Brad Pitt plays a former hotshot racer, Sonny Hayes, who was rising fast on the Formula One circuit for a hot minute in the early 90s, but who was badly injured in a devastating crash before he could notch a win. Now wrinkly, he lives out of a van and enters mid-tier races whenever a bill comes due, having lost the winnings from his hotshot era to a gambling problem. If you're wondering whether Sonny Hayes might want and get a shot at redemption, you've probably seen movies before. Sonny records a little win in Daytona for a little purse to open the movie, and the little news item that this generates prompts a visit from his old teammate Ruben, Javier Bardem. Ruben owns the Apex GP team, who are in trouble because all their drivers are young hotshots like Sonny used to be, undisciplined and brash. An experienced driver is Ruben's only hope of improving their disastrous season, which, if it continues along these lines, will put his ownership at the mercy of the board. Ruben is a gajillionaire, and the reason we have Sonny's quest for glory up in the foreground is so we won't think too hard about the fact that the only person with anything at stake is a gajillionaire, who, if worse were to come to worst, would be absolutely fine. A third character arc is introduced when we meet the brash and undisciplined current hotshot who will be Sonny's teammate, Joshua, Damson Idris, a beautiful black British millennial whose lack of discipline is a matter of misplaced priorities. He hasn't won a race yet, but that hasn't stopped the media from treating him like a big shot, and it's gone to his head. With no small amount of encouragement from his manager and cousin, who is his same age, he has come to view image management as the most important part of his job. He doesn't realize it's supposed to be about the poetry of asphalt and gasoline, or whatever auto racers tell themselves. If you're wondering whether Joshua will get it straight and finally learn where an athlete's self-respect comes from, you've probably seen movies before. I've grown tired of summarizing this shop-worn plot, and I haven't even gotten to Sonny's love interest yet. All the human material is shopworn, exhausted even, a hodgepodge of sports movie cliches that by 2025 has begun to fray like the DNA of purebred dogs. The supposed personal values of the athletes, grit, perseverance, proving you're the best, etc., the things more important than money that have always made up the moral and emotional bedrock of sports movies, these things have become pathetically hard to sell in an age where a 2.5 hour brand orgy can be passed off as a movie. But Aaron Kruger's script puts us through the paces. Joshua's mother is afraid he will go out the same way Sonny did at the same age, and that Sonny's waxing influence on him will increase this risk. We learn that Sonny loves to race because it makes him feel like he's flying, and that he will die if he has another crash. The love interest is a hard-headed woman technician on the team who had to fight to get ahead in a man's world, but who melts when somebody finally appeals to her feminine side. It's a soulless part that makes for a waste of Carrie Condon. We discovered that the board's big shark investor, Tobias Menzies, is secretly trying to sabotage the season so that a sale will go through and he can tear the organization down and start over with a bigger stake and tighter control. This is a very au courant villain, which is turbocharged to keep the underdog energy going. Can you imagine someone greedy enough to have all this and want more? But it's put over with cartoonish insistence. Every time the team is dealt a setback during the final race, we get a reaction shot from Menzies going, Oh no. And these class calisthenics still can't get our so-called underdog one step closer to recognizable scrappiness. All these story particles arrive already drained of all life, and Kruger's dialogue is only as good and punchy as it needs to be about 30% of the time, if I'm being generous. The rest of the time, it's blunt force exposition, with the main points most often repeated seconds later in dumbed-down form, so that most of the scenes of dramatic development end on lines like, "Listen, let's get this straight. We all lose our jobs if you can't pull off a miracle." In movies about specialists of any kind, the next-door neighbor of exposition is technical explanation. And if you don't know racing rules and strategy, good news. The largest speaking part in the film belongs to an impossibly chipper British announcer who calls every race and insultingly over-explains the significance of every move and moment. Every move and moment of Sonny and Joshua's, that is, because they are the main characters. The announcer has no interest in the 20 other cars on the track. Even a child would find this man overbearing. I spent these scenes imagining how this kind of play-by-play would sound on a telecast of a sport I do follow, e.g., "Oh no, he dropped that fly ball," which is a shame because now the runners can advance. What he wanted to do instead of dropping it was catch it, because that way he would have made the second out, bringing the defense one out closer to the magic number of three outs required to, etc. The only thing sadder than this motor-mouthed god voice being a constant superfluous presence is the fact that sometimes it isn't superfluous because Kaczynski, the director, almost never allows us to just see the whole course and observe for ourselves what's going on. So fearful is he that this would make the movie as boring as watching racing on TV. Kaczynski came to the world's attention a few years ago when he directed Tom Cruise in Top Gun Maverick, and though it made sense on paper that he could replace Cruise with Brad Pitt and fighter jets with race cars, the conversion rate between the currencies turns out not to be favorable for F1 at all. The races are not fluid. They're held together by the relentless slam-bang cutting style of the contemporary action movie, smashing us into a new perspective every second. Now we're in the driver's seat. Now we're along the tires. Now the cars are coming toward us. Now we're looking at the map and aren't sure why. We get this rickety hopping around in place of an organizing vision. There's a critical moment in the final race when our two heroes are working together strategically to box out a third driver, and the excitable British announcer is saying, "This is racing ballet!" And you just can't see what it is they're doing. This central failure, making a mess of the racetracks, means Kaczynski will have to prove his mettle elsewhere, and he simply doesn't. The globetrotting of the F1 circuit is a narrative waste, since you never see anything outside the stadiums to distinguish, e.g., Hungary from Mexico, until you get to a place of real history and character, by which I mean a place with enough ambient advertising to be worth slowing down to explore, Las Vegas. The only place where Kaczynski is at home is in the Apex GP facilities, they of the gleaming surfaces. And these settings, the tracks, garages, pit booths, gyms, locker rooms, conference rooms, wind tunnel, simulator, are so uncanny that both the conflicts and the synergies meant to play out against them are automatically diminished in significance because they make everything seem like it's happening to high-end androids. There are interesting things to be learned here concerning how a racing team actually works, what precise role each member of the staff plays, and how they all make each other better. But the ambiance is perfectly clean and white and glossy everywhere, so none of it can feel like real work or real joy. As the critic Brendan Boyle put it, this is a found family that lives together in an Apple store. Everything comes back to the slickness, which becomes nearly an anti-aesthetic. You can't ever grab a hold of anything. Every image is encrusted with wealth in a way that says it's not for you. The titles are as fascistly huge and white as the walls. Hans Zimmer's interns embarrass themselves trying to copy the Reznor-Ross techno score for Challengers with none of the sex or anger. It's a video game score, to match the other obvious video game gestures, like the ubiquitous announcer and the shots of the starting lights. There's even a split-screen shot where Sonny is player one and Joshua is player two. The only question is whether Kaczynski is deliberately emulating racing games, or whether that visual framework has simply colonized his mind. Ed Sheeran sings a song that sounds like it should have been sung by Bo Bice on American Idol in 2005. It's all meant to be familiar and comfortable, which is the opposite of what I think most people are seeking from a movie about driving race cars dangerously fast. But the slickest thing of all, the most diabolical demonstration of slickness in the whole movie, belongs to the screenplay, and how it reckons with the fact that the final race cannot have two winners. Kruger and Kaczynski and the seven producers found a way to make Sonny both the spiritual winner, who sacrifices his own chance to win for the sake of Joshua and his bright future, and the actual, eventual, literal winner. It's screenwriting quantum physics. And now we turn our attention to a movie that accomplishes something similarly impressive, but with real heart rather than by conspicuous calculations. Sorry, Baby is a patient and sharp-eyed movie that illuminates the distinctly millennial deadpan of its writer-director star, Eva Victor, from a comic and a tragic side at once. The film, which created huge buzz at Sundance and now comes to us courtesy of A24, is a tightrope walk of intimacy with somebody in pain, a story that seeks to understand a wounded protagonist, but by a gentle holding, rather than by the more typically brutal means of narrative dissection. If it were to press into this character any harder, or pull back from her any farther, it would all fall down. Despite the odd wobble, it does not fall down, and it's because Victor has a wisdom and empathy, an understanding of how to hold, that is rare for an artist of their age. It's a sweet and brave film, too curious to be cynical and too smart to be mushy. It looks the world over and manages to make a warm refuge without telling lies. And it is due to this ability, so valuable among dramatists, that Victor has suddenly become someone to watch. Their protagonist, Agnes, is rigidly armored in the affectless affect that so many young millennials adopted in adolescence to defend themselves in a marketing-saturated culture that made sincerity into a sucker's game. And it is the way that Victor gets you to see these origins, the way they shine out from an intuitive grasp of the character's past, that makes their performance so special and so tempting to use as a psychoanalytic cipher for a whole generation. Pronoun clarification, Victor is said to go by they-she, but Agnes is most often called she and her in the movie, even though her jury duty scene begins with her trying to find a way to indicate something like they-she or she-they by creative emendations to the MF bubbles on the intake form. Most of the humor in the film follows from the narrow range of expression that Agnes wears in public. The blankness of her resting face and her impassive mezzo forte voice frequently belie her trenchant intelligence and capacity for passion. And perhaps a third of the laughs that Victor earns come when Agnes responds to somebody's weird question or comment with a simple, "What?" Characters like Enid from Ghost World or MTV's Daria come to mind when you first meet her. But to the film's credit, it refuses to rest here and make Agnes superior or bewildered relative to her surroundings, nor does it insist on prying her open like a medical specimen to show us what her attitude hides. Instead, it reaches out to her in a spirit of fondness and respect, simply wanting to get to know her better, and so do we, because the sensitivity of Victor's conception of the character endears her to us in an instant. Most stories about armored characters talk down to them, treating them like arrested development cases, people to whom the armor welded itself while they were still young to prevent them ever having to really deal with anything. That's not Agnes. Her armor isn't something that sprang from an unconscious defect, it's her deliberate creation. And she knows how to take it off, she just doesn't usually want to, and knows she doesn't have to. The writer-director star often goes wrong by taking their character as a given. They assume that their knowledge of the character from the inside will automatically bring that inside out, transmit it. But sometimes they don't do the acting work to develop that inside and keep its flame alive during shooting. Or, if they clear that hurdle as an actor, they may fail as a director by keeping the film so locked into the character's subjective experience that it becomes insular. Victor, who was only 30 at the time of making this, their debut feature film, has avoided both these traps. In Sorry Baby, Victor is both Agnes and the person on the other end of the story's exchange, the person discovering her. A frivolous comedy centered on a character like Agnes would be a pleasant diversion, but what gives Sorry Baby its dramatic spikes is that these warm and earnest efforts to get close to her coincide with the defining trauma of her young adulthood, a sexual assault at the hands of a trusted mentor. Our heartfelt desire for intimacy of one kind with her must be measured against someone else's selfish and destructive attempt to force another kind. Our desire to earn her trust must come as she's recovering from its all-time most severe violation. It's risky terrain, especially for a first-time filmmaker, requiring a firm grasp of the boundaries around characters and of how cinema negotiates them. But Victor demonstrates such remarkable poise in presenting Agnes that by the end you might be wondering whether any arrangement of talent other than a one-person show, a writer-director-star project, could have done it. As we open on Agnes, there is someone in her life, exactly one person, who already has her trust. Her best friend, Liddy, Naomi Ackie, who was part of the same thesis cohort in grad school and was also being advised by the man who would become Agnes's assailant. When it's just Agnes and Liddy, which is the dramatic configuration of about half the movie's scenes, Agnes is very nearly a different person. Considerably more relaxed than in any other time, including when she's alone. She is, in fact, terribly anxious when alone, as survivors of attacks often are. It is only when she's got Liddy all to herself that she seems capable of smiling. These are the scenes that let us know that we can trust Agnes to handle her armor and that simultaneously make us yearn to see more of the person underneath it. This is the exact chemistry of the experience of getting closer to someone. Victor makes it feel special not just by making Agnes so appealing, but by giving us such a strong sense of her two faces, each of them equally real, but one reserved for privileged company. We get a rush of dear feelings when we see Agnes happy and yearn to join that company, to be in Liddy's shoes. This is the primary dramatic reason for Liddy's existence. Agnes is the one character in every scene, and this is her story. But Naomi Ackie, an actress with a radiant charm all out of proportion to the terrible characters in terrible movies like Blink Twice and Mickey 17 that she has up to now been stuck in, gives Liddy flesh and breath. She does especially wonderful work by modulating her voice. In every scene, she seems to be using her voice as a net to catch Agnes wherever she is. Everything she speaks to her carrying the undercurrent of "I got you" that best friends are counted on for. This is the central model of trust in the story that the camera makes us, the audience, hope we can replicate. This is the unconditional love that gets Agnes smiling, and it's why Liddy's eventually falling in love, having a baby, and moving away, because she has a life of her own, hits Agnes so hard. We in fact meet this vulnerable smiling Agnes first, because the movie's first scene depicts Liddy coming to visit. At this time, Agnes has just received a full-time faculty position at her university, yet it is clear that something heavy presses on her psyche. A dinner party with the rest of their old cohort goes from awkward to fraught when their antisocial colleague Natasha, one of the movie's weaker inventions, who seems like a Seinfeld character, specifically one of Elaine's co-workers that it kills her not to be able to please, mentions their old advisor, and Agnes freezes in terror, prompting Liddy to put her hand on her knee and ground her. The assault is in the past, but Natasha doesn't know about it, and at this point neither do we. Victor has set effect before cause to pique our curiosity, and because we already like Agnes, it is a curiosity of the heart, an involved curiosity, and not just a matter of wondering how a clever narrative device will play out. Liddy concludes her visit by promising her everlasting availability to Agnes, and Agnes responds by saying, "Don't worry, if I were going to kill myself, I would have done it last year, or the year before that, or God, definitely the year before that." From here, as it seems it must, the movie's chronology fractures, and it takes us back to the trauma 3 years past. We see how Agnes was singled out by her advisor, Decker, Louis Cancelmi, how he called her work extraordinary and subsequently poisoned that word for her, a poisoning that is called back to with great skill. What makes this setup material so strong is that it's clear that Decker wasn't purely trying to groom Agnes for sex. He was, but he also really meant what he said about her work, which makes his transgression vastly more painful. We don't witness the assault, but stay outside Decker's house that fateful day as it becomes evening and then night, until we finally see Agnes crash out of the front door, tie up her boots, part way, in what you can tell even from across the street is a daze, and then drive home in silence, where ashen in the bathtub she recounts the incident to Liddy. We've seen this character's everyday armor by this point, and this is something else, something much graver, the disembodiedness of traumatic aftermath. This is one of the movie's stunning scenes. The clumsiness of the telling, the fog of confusion, the softness of Liddy's response, the inability of either to use any of the direct words for what Decker did to Agnes, for fear that affixing those labels will be the act that engraves this horror in Agnes's life story. It is amazing to see subject matter of this kind of explosiveness treated with such delicacy, never once getting anywhere near the language of grandstanding. Victor knows to stay with the characters. Agnes puts her everyday armor back on the next day when she visits the ER and the university administrators, two scenes that serve their structural requirements despite supporting characters that, like Natasha, also cut a little close to caricature territory. And you are invited to see the new sad purpose with which that armor is now charged. We will crawl forward in time over the 3 years from that event to the present day where we began, and this is what will make the meat of the movie, a witnessing of Agnes's stutter-step return to self-possession. It will get both funnier and spikier from here, and with no appearance of effort because Victor's talent for realism is already so fully realized. A two-scene sequence of her adopting a kitten she finds on the street made me laugh harder than anything I've seen in a movie all year. Yet, newly painful kinds of intimacy arise from this choice, most memorably when Agnes has to put a tortured mouse out of its misery. A little later, she begins a relationship with her neighbor Gavin, Lucas Hedges, and begins to find her way back to healthy, happy sex. A late scene that returns us to the bathtub, in which Agnes and Gavin now embrace and chat about the future, brings another kind of painful closeness to the surface, when it becomes clear that their sexual involvement now doesn't mean that they're compatible as people, the way Agnes is with Liddy, and that Gavin's basic sweet-faced decency doesn't preclude his making his own kind of male impositions. The title refers directly to the final scene, in which Agnes is watching Liddy's baby while Liddy and her partner are out hiking, and apologizing to the baby for the certainty of hardships to come in her life, while promising to be there for her if ever she needs emotional support, the way Liddy has been for Agnes. It's the kind of scene that would be saccharine in perhaps 4 out of 5 contexts, but this movie has found the exceptional one in which it is lovely and tender. Coming after all that Agnes has had to take and hold inside, it is her moment of radical acceptance, and it crystallizes the title as an expression of her willingness to love herself, to reconcile the baby and the adult inside her, which is the only basis from which it is possible to move on from trauma at all. It may not be a perfect movie, it has its elisions, but it is wonderful in a social media-driven culture that has cheapened and even weaponized the language of psychotherapy to see meaning restored to the idea of healing. My theme music is by me and Johann Wagner. My logo design is by Aaron Robert Miller. Find these and more than 1,000 of my other reviews in writing at letterboxd.com/QUILLH. I'm Will Hatman, and I'll keep watching if you do.